Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. For those of you who are just joining us, be forewarned, this is a shaggy dog story that has been going on for a whole bunch of months now. It's about San Diego in the 1990s and a long walk and about an artist and an installation done in a small chapel in San Diego many decades ago. If you want to dial in to the beginning of the story, I strongly encourage you to go to Spotify and search for The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and you should be able to bring up all the past episodes. That should get you up to speed. As always, the views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the host and not necessarily those of the staff or management of KOWS Community Radio. Welcome back, everyone, to West County and the not the dog days of summer, but really the moist and overcast and gray days of summer. I don't think I'm alone, or I may not be alone, in wishing that this marine layer that is cloaking us all morning long and even all day long and dampening, literally, our moods would lighten up a little. I know we can use the moisture, we always can, but I'm just craving some sunlight here in West Sebastopol. So, probably like no small number of you, I have my own set of craziness going on in my life right now. I was recently, actually just yesterday, talking with my dearest brother down in Santa Cruz, and I told him that I was trying to figure out what to do, and I wanted to write about it, I wanted to talk about it, but then I felt like I was kind of like one of those persons in the yard in Auschwitz or Birkenau writing poetry about the smoke coming out of the crematorium. And I was wondering, well, what point is there in doing that? And I'd basically made that up, but my brother informed me, as he often does with curious facts, that in fact there were a lot of people, more than a handful, who in fact were writing poetry describing the smoke billowing out of those chimneys. And they took those words, in fact their final words, and they thought perhaps that they should be kept for posterity, that if they could be saved, some future generations might learn or benefit from whatever poignant and dear thoughts and observations that they had in that moment, in that final moment of their lives. And so they took their poems and their volumes and they buried them, apparently. And they hoped that at some point someone would discover them. Well, it turned out that after the war ended, World War II, Europe was just devastated, Eastern Europe in particular, and people had no food, they had no water, they scarcely had any fuel to heat their homes. And so they went out and they gathered what kindling they could, and they knew of these manuscripts, or somehow someone did, and in some cases they were dug up, and the people brought them home, and they were hungry and cold. And so they put the manuscripts into the wood stoves or into their ovens, and they lit them on fire and burned them so that they could keep warm. Somehow I take hope in that story, and I'm trying to figure out why. I'm wondering, I think perhaps because even though those poems and stories and observations were burned, we still know of them today. And perhaps that's the message that we should take with. For those of you who have been listening and following along for the last several months, you also know that I have a special add-on to this version of The Mountain. I'm telling or retelling the Tales of the Arabian Nights, that great compendium of stories that came out of the Middle East and Arabia and Persia and Turkey and Asia and Central Asia. Just a few days ago, I found myself in a curious situation or position. I was in a hospital, and I was talking to a doctor, a young doctor. She came from Persia. And as she was talking, I was looking at her, and it was almost as if I could see right into her and see her bloodline. I could see the parents that had given birth to her, and I could see the parents before them, and the parents before them, and even before them, going back far, far in time to the very birthplace of that great, or those great and ancient civilizations. And I thought, how strange to think that that line had somehow traveled through time all this way to this place, to this moment, her and I sitting together in a room, and her walking the hallways and corridors of this hospital, dispensing life and helping people, providing care. And that somehow this ancient world had delivered that care and that compassion to us in this moment. And then, of course, I could not help but think how strange as well that at this time we are attempting to literally destroy that civilization. We're not enabling our civilization. We're not valorizing the civilization of another. We are literally setting forth to destroy an ancient civilization, the place, the very place that was the birthplace of our world, the birthplace of our heritage, right there in the Middle East.
She's got a smile that it seems to me reminds me of childhood memories where everything was as fresh as the bright blue sky.
When we last left off a few weeks ago, we were still in the thralls of the stories being told by a set of old men to a genie, this great dark force, this force of cloud and rain and wind that had settled upon them. And there had been a merchant who had, unknown to himself, had smote the son of the genie and had taken his life. And the genie, this great titanic force, was set on taking the life of the merchant in revenge. And while the merchant sat in a godforsaken place awaiting his fate, three old men, one at a time, each of them happened upon him. And they vowed to sit with him to see what befell him. And they vowed not to leave him until his fate was fulfilled. And just as the genie was about to take the merchant's life, each of these old men had stepped forward and had asked the genie if he would grant a third of the man's blood, if he would listen to their tales, and if their tales were more fantastical than what had befallen the genie. And so it had happened that one man told of his wife who had betrayed him and he had then turned into a doe on a chain. Another man told the story of his brothers who had betrayed him and tried to kill him and had then been turned into two black dogs that accompanied him. And the third man, who bore with him a mule, he looked at the genie and he said simply, "This mule is my wife." And he explained that after he himself had been abroad for an entire year, he had returned home to find his wife in bed with a slave, and they were lying there in each other's arms, holding each other. They talked and flirted and laughed and kissed. And when she saw him at his side, when she saw him enter the room, she stood up and quickly she grabbed a cup of water. She spoke some words over it, and then she threw it in my face, said the merchant, said the old man. That she threw this in my face and she transformed me into a dog. And she chased me from the house. And I ran away, I ran as far as I could. I took refuge in the shop of a butcher. And there I nibbled on the bones in the ground. And the butcher, he took pity upon me, he brought me home. And his daughter took one look, she just glanced at me. And it was as if she saw straight through me into my being. And she said, "Why have you brought this strange man in?" And the butcher looked at his daughter's heat, and he said, "What man? What are you talking about? I just have this dog." And she said, "Oh, God, Father, can't you see? The dog is under a woman's spell." She said, "Please, just allow me to break it. I can do it." And the father said, "Well, for God's sake, do it. Break the spell. Return this man to his form." And so the daughter, she took a cup of water. She spoke some words over it. She threw it in my face and then said, "Return to your first form. Become the man that you once were." And there and then I changed back. And I was so grateful. I kissed her hands. And I was angry at that moment. I said, "Please cast a spell over my wife who did this." And she gave me a little of her water. And she instructed me. She said, "When you see your wife sleeping, go and splash this water upon her. And she will change into whatever you wish." And so I returned home. I saw her lying asleep in our bed, our marriage bed. And I splashed the water upon her. And I said, "Leave this form and become a mule." And in that very instant, she became the mule that you see right now with your own eyes, Lord and Sultan of the Great Jinn. And the genie, he laughed. It was as if he forgot his own sorrow and the loss of his son. And he granted this old man a third of his claim. And at that instant, he had no more claim on the merchant's life. And so he left. The merchant, of course, grateful for his life being spared, thanked the three old men. And then they wished him well, and they wished him safety, and they each went on their way. And he, the merchant, returned to his family, and he lived with them until the day that he died. And so why do we tell these stories? It's as if by telling a story, we transcend our own mortality and those great storms, those great washes of gray moisture and wind or sadness or events that oftentimes wash over us. They claim power over us. And by telling these stories, we in some ways regain our power. We assert our own humanity over these vast, uncontrollable things that afflict our lives. And it's as if we can entrance those forces, entrance those storms, and we can become stronger than them. We can become our own redoubt, that our own words can charm the disasters that befall us and transform those disasters, massage them into perhaps forms of grace and kindness.
Just from the river St. John's.
We don't know exactly from where the wood came. Perhaps it was from the pine forests that covered the Alabama and the Arkansas. These forests, these living things, were felled, and the timber was floated down the Mississippi to New Orleans. Then perhaps it was loaded onto a clipper and sailed through the Straits of Magellan and up the coast into San Francisco Bay and up the American River Delta to Sacramento. Or perhaps the wood was from one of the thousands of masted ships abandoned in San Francisco Bay by the sailors who had lit out for the gold fields. The ship would have been barged south and then dismantled by Chinese shipbreakers, and then the wood resold and floated upriver to Sacramento. From there it was freighted by wagon to the town of Auburn. The bray of the mule trains under lash, hordes of miners heading up the mountains seeking some small parcel to claim. Dust, stacking of wood, mottled in discolor of the timbers. In the streets, the stink of manure. Chaos and noise of thousands being outfitted. Dry dust of the California hills. But as for these long dead timbers, they would be reassembled into a long two-storied building fronting the main street of the boomtown. It would be named the Orleans Hotel for the provenance of that wood, so far away in what had once been a distant outpost of the Napoleonic Empire. We impress names upon places, and those names and the spirit and the history of those names are in turn cut like scars across place. A young girl pulls some boxes from white-capped water, and then her name is given to a river. In 1763, a surveyor and rounder from Northumberland and an astronomer who had studied at the Great Observatory of Greenwich were commissioned to fix the boundary between Pennsylvania and Maryland. And then a body of people who lived south of the Mason-Dixon line would come to live in Dixie. And they would whistle Dixie as they revolted themselves against the nation into which they had been born. And that mark on the earth, and the mark of the name, would identify them as a different people, even to this day. We best know the histories and the names if we are to know the place. Welcome back to the mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. And I'm your host, Andrew Lewis.
Grew up in town. Family was around. Backwood playground. Still remember the sounds of now. Oh, I can't go back. I cannot go home. My younger days are over. Thank you. have from the love of my own.
Meriwether Lewis and William Clark would part ways when the Corps of Discovery arrived back in St. Louis. One Corps member didn't even make it as far as St. Louis. Decommissioned 2 months earlier in Fort Mandan, John Coulter turned right around and traveled back upcountry with 2 other trappers. For him, there wasn't much to be had in the muddy streets of civilization. He would be the first white man to see the geysers of Yellowstone. His name would also be marked on the land, Coulter Bay and Coulter Peak. Decades later, rocks and logs would be found in the wilderness with his name and initials carved upon them. As for Toussaint Charbonneau, he was discharged when the Corps arrived back in Fort Mandan in August of 1806. He asked if he could accompany the Corps to St. Louis, but Clark responded curtly that his services were no longer needed. We get the sense Clark was keen to wash his hands of his troubles. But for the Indian girl and her young boy, it was a different matter. Clark was concerned about their dim prospects if they were to remain with the dissolute trapper. 3 days downriver, after leaving the Mandan village, Clark wrote a letter, an entreaty not without guile, and had it dispatched back to Charbonneau. "Your woman, who accompanied you that long, dangerous, and fatiguing route to the Pacific Ocean and back, deserved a greater reward for her attention and services on that route than we had in our power to give her at the Mandans. As to your little son, my boy Pomp, you well know my fondness of him and my anxiety to take him and raise him as my own child. If you are disposed to accept either of my offers to you and will bring down your son, your fam, Janie, had best come along with you to take care of the boy until I get him." There are some things that we can infer from that paragraph. From where did Clark's pet name for Tsegwazuweep come? Her name does not derive easily into Janie, but perhaps in frontier French it does. Janine, God's gracious one. Or the frontier English, Injun, or La Jeune, the young one. Come here, young one. Viens ici, jeune. Clark owed nothing to the girl they called the squaw, and even less to Toussaint. Clark was not fulfilling a contractual obligation. This was a passioned offer. We can infer that there was something of the young Indian woman that Clark loved. Once again, the baby Jean-Baptiste was in part a foil for something else. "I offer to raise your son, but I would like also for her to come along." He wanted to save her. In 1809, Toussaint made his way to St. Louis. Clark granted him some land to farm, but he did not take kindly to work that required tending. In 1811, he sold the land, and he and the Indian woman went back upriver. Behind them, they left the four-year-old child, Jean-Baptiste, in the care of William Clark in the frontier hamlet of Saint Louis. The father and the Indian girl were spotted on a boat going upriver, and it was noted in a passenger diary that the solitary couple had been part of the great expedition to the West. 2 years later, in 1811, the trapper Henry Breckinridge noted that Toussaint and his Indian had taken up at the Fort Lisa trading post. He noted that the young woman was sickly, and she longed to return to her native country. On December 20th, 1812, a clerk at the fort noted that the wife of Charbonneau, a Snake squaw, had died of childbed fever. She was barely 25, and she had just given birth to an infant girl. Fort Manuel stood abandoned by March 1813. Marauding Sioux would burn the buildings to the ground. In the 1960s, the Army Corps of Engineers erected dams, and the site eroded beneath the lapping waves of Lake Oahe. 25 years after Tsegwasweep's death, in the summer of 1837, after the snowbelt, the SS St. Peter, flying the pennant of the American Fur Company, steamed upriver to gather the pelts that had been hunted that spring. In its wake, it would leave a wave, and then a typhoon of smallpox that would sweep across the plains, decimating the Arakara, the Nez Perce, the Minnetarees, the Assiniboine, and the Sioux. It might be easy to condemn the captain for wanton disregard, and yet we only need look to the 21st century to see how reluctant all humans are to accept germ theory, how distrustful we are of quarantine and vaccination. Warnings had gone out onto the plains to not approach the trading post. Downriver, the warnings went unheeded. Far upriver, however, at the trading post of Fort Mackenzie, deep in Blackfeet country, no Indians came to trade that summer. In the fall, a representative rode far out into the land. At the great village of Three Forks, there was no sound, not a stirring of movement. Instead, the stench of death and hundreds of decaying forms of human beings, horses, and dogs lay scattered everywhere among the lodges. Among the carnage crawled two demented old women. The smell of the rotting flesh filled the air of the great plains. Tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, would die that summer. Of the Mandan, only 20 members of the tribe would survive. It wasn't just the people, but the life ways, the patterns of living that bound them together that would fray and become dismembered. The surviving peoples could not function as they had. The land was taken. The buffalo were extinguished, leaving great byres of bones littering the plains. At the crossing of the Missouri in Mobridge, South Dakota, stands a marker for the grave of the great chief Sitting Bull. In 1890, the ghost dance movement had been spreading across the plains. The Paiute Wovoka prophesied the rising of the dead and the return of the way of life of the plains Indians. In December 1890, Sitting Bull had allowed the ghost dance to occur at his encampment at the Standing Rock Agency. The Indian agent, fearing an uprising, ordered for Sitting Bull's arrest. On December 15th, 1890, Sitting Bull would be killed, shot in the head. A half-day walk north and 80 years distant, the body of a young girl lies buried in an unmarked grave on a shallow bluff on the Missouri. Separated by only a few miles, those two graves, that of Tagagawias and that of Sitting Bull, bookend a century, the invasion and settlement of a continent, and the extinguishing of many peoples.
A second chance would come with each new bridge you burn. I know you squandered some, but then from some you learn. And the point of rescue, you passed that long ago. Oh, but to hear you tell it was just another part of the show. Oh, Evangeline, your faith shone blind and true. We raise our glass and sing of you, Evangeline. Oh, Evangeline, you with no kith or kin. The night so hard and mean, you shed them like a skin. For you were always strong when the bats laid down to worse. You still had that song, it was your blessing and your curse. But in your tongue, there is no word for home. There'll be no to roll away the stone. Oh, Evangeline, you have been a prisoner here. Bread and roses we shall bring to you, Evangeline. You stayed out in that ring when nobody's even keeping the score. But round by round you earn your stumble into grace. Still with every turn the world becomes a sadder place. It swallows up the ones you have loved the most. So you sleep with none and you wake with ghosts. Oh, Evangeline, you have salted with your tears every lonely mile you've seen through the years, Evangeline. And no longer. of you even.
And some community events coming our way. What if your next vacation was a celebration of traditional music, song, and dance from around the world, nestled among the gorgeous redwoods of the Mendocino Woodlands? Lark Camp is a magical week running from July 31st to August 8th and features 80-plus inspiring instructors and workshops for all levels. It's a place to learn, create, and connect, no matter your experience. Whether you're trying something new or deepening your craft, bring your friends, bring your family, and dive into a joyful mix of classes, spontaneous jam sessions, and live music and dance every night. Find out more about this two-week event at larkcamp.org. And KC Turner Presents invites you to experience music, dining, drink, and a good time with friends and neighbors. Some great music is coming your way at Hop Monk Novato, located at 224 Vintage Way in Novato. There are some great sounds in store over the next couple of months. On Friday, July 31st at 6 p.m., as part of the Cookout Series, Eileen Jewell will be performing in Novato at the Hop Monk. You can visit hopmonk.com/Novato for more information. Farm to Pantry has been nurturing the community of Sonoma County since 2008. Living in such a bountiful spot on earth, it is essential that we ensure all residents have access to the beautiful, locally grown produce available in our backyards and farms. Check out farmtopantry.org to learn more about the food justice programs, including child nutrition education, where you can get involved, etc. Volunteer to connect with kind people and ask about their cool swag items. When looking for rental housing, you probably won't hear comments like, "The apartment is still available unless you have children or have a disability." Housing discrimination is rarely this obvious, but it's just as real and just as illegal. If you suspect discrimination or differential treatment, contact Fair Housing Advocates of Northern California. If you suspect discrimination, 415-457-5025. And the Sonoma County Historical Society promotes Sonoma County's diverse heritage through education, preservation, and community engagement. Since 1962, the Society has been collecting, preserving, and retelling Sonoma County's stories. From the quirky, clever, and downright scandalous personalities who shaped our county to the places and events that bore witness to spectacular milestones in our past, they celebrate our county's heritage while enriching its future. To become a member or find out more about events and programs that the organization promotes, visit SonomaCountyHistory.org, and that's all one word, SonomaCountyHistory.org. You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and I'm your host, Andrew Lewis. Thanks for joining me. I have a special favor to ask. I'd like to ask you to hang on, especially those who might feel a loneliness more profound than any being has a right to bear. Hang on just for a little while longer. I need your company to keep. If you would like to know more about the texture of the American West or its nascence, or would like to know more about the Western fur trade, Bernard DeVoto's wonderful history across the wide Missouri is highly recommended. A special thanks goes out to my friend Hank Birnbaum, who over 1 week in 2001 invited me to schlep his stuff from Seattle to Concord, California, across the Sierra Nevada, and over the Bitterroots to Lake Pend'Oreille. It was on that drive that, quite by accident, I stumbled across Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau's grave there in the desert, and then headlong into two decades of questioning. We open today with Nowhere to Hide by the ever-wonderful Trampled by Turtles. We followed with Sweet Child of Mine, that Guns N' Roses song covered by Viggo Mortensen, George McKay, Samantha Eisler, Annalise Basso, Nicholas Hamilton, and Kirk Ross, followed by The River St. John's, sung by Jake Fussell, O Evangeline, sung by Emmylou Harris. And we'll be turning out the lights with Another Time and Place, sung by Dave Von Ronk, and Meet Me on the Mountain, as performed by Fruition and Grant Farm. If you're enjoying this show, I really encourage you to subscribe to The Mountain on Substack. Just Google The Mountain, An Adoration in a Multitude of Parts. The link will appear, and if you subscribe, you can be apprised of all things Mountain. Eventually, I'll be transferring an archive of all these shows onto the Substack so people can catch up on all the previous stories. It's also the best way to stay notified when new episodes drop, as well as hopefully receive new kinds of content not available elsewhere. If you're enjoying these stories, and if you're enjoying the listen, and it makes your world a little bigger, I would be grateful and indebted if you would share with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night wherever you are.
First I met you years ago in another time and place. The thought came to my mind, I'd never seen a kinder face. A warmer laugh, a gentler smile, a eyes so full of light. I'd be a fool if I didn't fall in love with you that night. We've tramped around the world, my dear, our fortune was to roam. But each place that I've been with you, that place has been my home. If now I wander on alone with no place to abide, I'll be content, for I was sent those wanderings at your side. Love that blossoms in the night can't stand the test of time. It ebbs and flows, it comes and goes, no reason, reach, nor rhyme. As each day becomes another day, each year another year, I'd trade a year in heaven for a day with you, my dear. Flow on and I am gone to a wild and empty land. Time is like an empty room and space an empty hand. And the things we said and the jokes we made are echoes in the waste. We'll meet again where hills are green in another time and place. Thank you. first I met you years ago in another time and place. A thought came to my mind, I'd never seen a kinder face. A warmer laugh, a gentler smile of eyes, so full of light. I'd be a fool if I didn't fall in love with you that night.
Meet me on the mountain where the wind, keeps blowing our blues away. Meet me on the mountain before we must be on our way.
It's good to see you, my friend. Something I wanna say, I can't meet you today. So won't you meet me on that mountain in the morning light?
Meet me on the mountain where the wind keeps blowing our blues away. Someday we